Very good. Before we get started, I've got a couple of very quick announcements. The first one is next week, amazingly enough, is Thanksgiving week. It's very hard for me to accept that. It feels like it's much earlier in the year to me. But as is our normal custom on Thanksgiving, we do not do a chart book Wednesday night. There will be no chart book next week, and there will obviously be no Thanksgiving conference call on Thursday. If the market does some really wacky stuff going into Thanksgiving, we will do a pre-recorded call. We will be around until Friday easily, so we will be checking emails periodically to answer questions. But frankly, my goal is to sort of relax and chill, and probably a lot of us are. I don't know about you guys. This has been a tough year. And I'm sort of looking forward to next year and an easier year if we have it. I'm working on those projections now. So no chart book, no call next week. With that, we'll get right into the call. Apologize, my dog is normally out, by the way, during the conference call. She's home, but she's lying down. If you hear a lot of barking, everything's fine. Realize she's barking. So let's get right into it here. We really don't have any change on our view for stocks going into mid-December. In other words, you know, the S&P is recovering. The Russell is not. Every time we do a meeting, we did two meetings yesterday, everyone talks about the divergences and the non-confirmations, and our view is going into the end of the year, especially, that just doesn't matter. You're going to see this hedge fund chasing. You're going to see everyone buying, you know, the stocks that are within 10% of their highs. You know, I have suggested, you know, just buying Home Depot, Starbucks, and Facebook and sitting there like an idiot. I know that sounds stupid, but that's what's probably going to work going into the close of the year here because of the chasing. And I'm going to paraphrase Jeff Garbaz in our discussion last week. Jeff can, of course, modify this and when he comes on the call. But basically, Jeff does a lot of work with different hedge funds and different funds. I believe his average client is down anywhere from 7 to 9%. And he also mentioned he only had one client that was having a positive year. And all the people he's worked with, Jeff has been doing this since 1990 on an independent basis. So in other words, this is a really bad year for a lot of people. Most of the people on our conference call, certainly the people we had lunch with yesterday, are doing much better than those funds. But we have to acknowledge that they're going to try to play catch up here. Jeff, of course, can modify that or comment on that when it's his turn. I want to talk for just a second about the stochastics because of an email that I received from one of our clients that makes a lot of sense, and that is, you know, we use the stochastic oscillator as a way to identify areas of risk and reward, not necessarily as buy and sell signals. You know, you don't need me to tell you that every major decline on the stochastic or in the market seems to start from a stochastic that's at 80. And while there can be continuation, when that stochastic gets down to 20, the idea is they're lower risk. The reason I teach that indicator is not to give people an area of tops and bottoms. What I teach is more, or why I teach it is risk and reward, so that you can look at your portfolio when new money comes in and say, golly, I want to add money to X because the stochastic is down at 20 rather than Y when the stochastic is up at 80. It gives good buy and sell signals. Much of the time we tend to forget, though, that the reason I use the indicator is it's quicker than a lot of indicators that do find real tops and bottoms. We use our Fred's Price Oscillator more for identifying tops and bottoms. In other words, you know, last week when that thing was up at plus 15, or I guess 2 weeks ago, we were able to look for a down week. when that thing got down to minus 15 during the correction, we were able to identify the possibility of a rally. You know, so in other words, if we, let's say, for example, because we're all doing this, at least you all are doing this, you're running a portfolio and all of a sudden your firm adds a stock to the model. And you look at that stock and you say, well, if I add that today, am I going to be early? Am I going to be late? Has everyone already figured this out or whatever? What I have found very helpful, and I know a lot of my advisors at Merrill Lynch when I was teaching this and at Robinson Humphrey when I was teaching this, one of the things that helped them was to say, okay, the firm has come out with Apple or Amazon or whatever, and the stochastic is at 20. It's okay to add right now. If the stochastic is at 90, you know, you might say, golly, I'm going to wait on this a little bit, see if the stochastic comes down to 20. The really cool thing about that indicator is if the market goes sideways, that indicator will come down and give you a buy signal. And that's why we like it so much. It's not necessarily absolute tops and bottoms. Let's get into and let's think about one other thing when I'm saying risk and reward versus buy versus sell. I was a semi-professional chess player during my first years in college, and it's very helpful in chess to think backwards. You know, as most people say, how many moves ahead do you look? And the answer is, it rapidly becomes infinite. What you do in chess, if you're a strong player, is you say, I want to get to a certain position where I know I have an advantage, and I'm here now. I have to go from here to that position. How do I get there? What moves do I make to get there? What can my opponent do to keep me from getting there? This is sort of the same. If you get a report, you know, from on a stock that says the stock is going to go up 30% from your firm, you know, you look at it and you say, okay, what does it have to do to go up to 30%? And if your stochastic is lower, that gives you an idea saying, okay, at least it can start going to the 30% now, up that 30%, rather than, golly, it's already gone up a whole bunch and the stochastic on the weekly is stuck, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and it may not do that. So, you know, I tend to think of it that way with this indicator. Let's get into bonds. We had a couple of interesting questions on bonds this week. Probably the best one was, God, you know, Fred, I know you don't like them, but I'm thinking of buying them. And I want to encourage people on the call to ask that sort of question. My job is twofold. My job is to help you guys buy the stuff you want to buy and suggest stuff that I would buy. But if you want to buy bonds, even though I wouldn't do it, I'd be glad to help you do it. So one of the things, though, people have been asking about bonds is, can we buy them because the daily stochastic is just coming out of 20? And the answer to me is, you know, they should rally and make a lower high. But let's say we want to buy bonds for the Fed announcement, which may not be a bad idea. In other words, we've been saying bonds will be where they are, you know, when the Fed raises rates, as if they had already raised them. The market will discount that. One of the tricks to that is going to be finding another Treasury bond ETF besides TLT. In other words, you can look at how TLT performs, but that's where all the whipsaws and strange stuff is going to occur. You may want to take a look at something like, I'll publish a list of them in the report this week. I'll take a look at those. But there's a 30-year bond ETF. There's a 10-year bond ETF. I like IEI because it should go up, even if it doesn't really, you know, even if you know, it doesn't go up as much. TLH is an interesting alternative. IEF, IEI, those are all interesting alternatives. You can put a stop loss in on those, and in addition, watch and see if TLT flirts with its stop area. I think what is going to happen after the Fed raises rates is bonds are going to end up being quite volatile for a while, but may not collapse. The drop should be after the Fed raises these rates. So let's look at it that way. Any questions like that, though, I would very happily take. I want to look at currencies and commodities just for a minute. We are still of the view that the dollar is going to make a short-term peak in this area. I would caution everybody, that's sort of out of consensus here. But we think the dollar is going to make a short-term peak and that will benefit these commodities. And we want to see oil, of course, back above 42.50. I do caution everybody here that commodities and the dollar long-term are not correlated. We do some work with a good friend of ours and a very, very smart mathematician and engineer in Arizona, my friend Lou Cinto. Lou did an analysis for me a year or two ago showing basically that long-term there's not a lot of correlation between the dollar and commodities. If Lou is on the call and he wants to chime in, he is more than welcome to do that in the Q&A period after I'm through talking. The other thing I will mention on gold is it's very interesting. We had a double inside day formation on GLD, and GLD has now taken out the high of the second one of these days. In other words, we blew through the first one. It gave a sell signal. The next day was an inside day saying get out of the position because it didn't continue. You got out with a little bit of a profit if you sold at that low, and it's now through the high of the other day. So we may actually see some rally in gold and commodities here. You know, I'm still worried about tax selling in this area. I am not going to leap all over this, but you know it is tradable if you want to try to trade it with a stop. So we'll see how that goes. But my real concern is that these commodities stabilize, that oil can get back above 42.50. We do like the Chinese ETFs when we look at the international markets. It does look to us like China has bottomed. We forecast that bottom. It still looks like that's happening. In meetings yesterday, again, very few people have been willing to say, golly, we think China has bottomed. Remember, by the way, that bottom does not necessarily mean rally strongly. It means just stop going down. A period of basing going into the end of the year is very likely. But we still like the unhedged currency ETFs, as well as the hedged ones. When I look at SCJ in Japan, for example, that's trading at least as well as DXJ and in some respects better. So we want to own an equal amount of both of those in Japan and also in Europe. With that, I'm going to pass the call over to Jeff Garbaz for some questions. Jeff, have you got anything for me?
Hey, Fred. How are you?
I am fine, Jeff. How are you? I'm sorry I haven't been back to you this week. We haven't talked at all, and I apologize.
Right. Hey, so first question for you is Russell and MidCap, so IWM and MDY, still are lagging. You know, we held your 204, 205 level. We're back above it. You know, we're working back up to 211, see if we can kind of get there. At some point, if this move is going to continue, and maybe we get your outlier of 223 this year, should we expect to see IWM and MDY start to, you know, outperform?
I would say no. I would say those actually should lag until mid-December. You know, Jeff, you're a better judge of this than me, but my guess is what you're going to see is the hedge funds chase performance until mid-December and then start to think about where they want to be for 2016. When they start thinking about where they want to be in 2016, hopefully that will be when those markets start to broaden out. But, you know, Jeff, you know, we've always talked about how bull and bear markets have a hook that keeps people out, okay? And the hook this time seems to me to be everyone talking about the fact that the market is narrow. You know, in other words, you know, Jeff, if I were to say to you, the S&P could go up 10% here, but since the broad market isn't going up at all, you shouldn't buy the S&P because that 10%, after it goes up 10, 11%, will be retraced quickly. you know, you'd probably buy the S&P, right?
Right.
That's what I'm saying here, and what everyone else seems to be saying is just what I said. The S&P may advance, but it's not a good advance, so don't participate because it's going to go away soon, right? And, you know, I prefer to wait until, you know, buy the S&P, watch the other stuff out of the corner of my eye, and if I start to get really good selling indications on the S&P or it starts to drop down through benchmarks, you don't worry about selling it then. Remember, this is really important for everybody on the call, and I hope it remains true, but I have every reason to believe that it will remain completely true. The stock market, when it starts to go down, the biggest down moves are, in virtually every case I can find, at the end of a move. In other words, you don't get the big crash move off the top. You get the big crash move at the bottom when there's capitulation. In commodities, very often that big crash move occurs at the beginning of the move. You know, especially if you look at some of the agricultural commodity charts back in the 70s, what you see is when those commodities, which were really frothy, started to go down, they'd open up down the limit and go down the limit for several days. In other words, it just blindsided you and wrecked you. But, Jeff, there's a reason for that that most people don't fully understand, because most people nowadays don't actually trade commodity futures. The reason is, there's a difference in margin between commodities and stocks. You know, we all look at the margin, you know, numbers and stuff on stocks as an indicator, but there is a key difference. I'm going to tell everybody what it is. The difference is margin in stocks is 50% Reg T. Margin in commodities is a good faith deposit of 3-5% that you make when you buy your initial commodity. Very few people plunk down the full value of a contract when they buy a commodity. They do it on margin as a matter of course, and the margin is very, very low. When you use margin, when you use your buying power in commodities as that market's going up to add more contracts, you're doing it on 3-5% margin, not 50%. So you end up building an inverse pyramid that's standing on its point instead of standing on its base. And when the market starts to fall off, immediately margin calls are generated. With stocks, you don't get the margin calls for a while after the decline. And so I guess the reason, roundabout thing I'm trying to tell people with that is I'm not worried about coming in and finding the S&P opening at 190 on the first breakdown move, right? I would look for that at the end of the move. But we in most cases, and think back to all the little mini crashes and stuff we've lived through, in most cases, the mini crash occurs, or the crash occurs, after the market has been going down for some time. In October of 87, the market went down 500 points in one day. What everyone tends to forget is the market started going down in August and went down 500 points from August to October before it went down that 500 points. So in other words, I think judicious use of benchmarks and cranial facilities will enable us to sidestep a crash in the S&P, or at least mitigate the effects of it, because it won't happen off the top. Now, obviously, if a wacky news item comes out, let's say ISIS does bomb Washington or New York, or President Obama is shot or whatever, yeah, you're going to get a really bad reaction in the next day. But I will say that those events are exceedingly difficult to forecast, and if you've got clients that are really worried about that sort of event, they probably should have very light stock allocations. And that's, of course, up to you, but it's not something that I would worry about at this time. We've got plenty of benchmarks. We've got plenty of things. You know, if the spider starts going below the last low that we've seen, which, according to my charting unit, was 202.18. So if we start going below 202, excellent chance that the decline is resuming. Sell a bunch of stuff. And 202 to 208, if I normally would like to risk 5%, that's still less than 5%. So you see what I'm saying? So in other words, I think we should participate in the S&P. As stupid as it sounds, we should all buy Home Depot at new highs today and watch it go up into the end of the year, obviously with a benchmark and with a stop, and not worry so much, but keep our eyes on the broad market as it doesn't go up. I hope I answered that question. I probably answered it in more detail than anyone wanted.
That's all right. So what do you think about XLV here? I mean, they're getting hit today because the rumor is that UNH may bag out of Obamacare. And if we find that, like, it starts becoming more of these guys doing it and the whole thing becomes a disaster, do we want to stay underweight in healthcare from a technical charting perspective right now? I mean, you made a great call when you came out of it, kind of mid-year. What are you thinking as we go in the 16, given the backdrop of like this kind of recent news thing we got?
As we get closer to 2016, I'm going to be looking at XLV very carefully. Our sector review should be coming out today. We remain underweight healthcare at least into the end of the year. The chart justifies that. And also, Jeff, I mean, and you're free to comment on this, I still think there's a fair bit of fast money stuck in these things. You know, I fully understand and believe in the idea that there's going to be a biotech revolution in the next 20 years that is going to make our lives better. But at the same time, that's been discounted in my view, and the risk is that these stocks go nowhere for a while or down until the fast money exit. You know, Jeff, you were with me at Robinson Humphrey with Helene Becker, who was a great analyst, may still be around for all I knew. No, who talked about Amgen almost every day in 1990, and it didn't even start going up until 1994. Right, biotech revolution, all this stuff. She was way ahead of her time, you know. And for most of our clients, you know, most of our clients really, you know, they say they're long-term investors, but most of our clients really have a year time horizon. And by that, what I mean is, and this is worth thinking about, and Jeff, it's different from what you do. You know, we've got clients that are being called by their clients and judged on how well they do every year, right? If, and I mentioned this to some big producers at Morgan Stanley here in Atlanta yesterday. I said, you know, golly, let's say we're worried about the divergences. We do the prudent thing and we just go to 90% cash because within a year or so, the market should start going down and we could have a really bad market. Would you guys have clients left was the question I asked them. The answer is no. The problem they have is they have to be in when they're going up. The clients tend to say, you need to get me out at the exact peak so I miss the entire decline. That's not possible. But, you know, I think the biotech thing and the healthcare thing could actually go sideways for a year or so before it picks up again while all that fast money is coming out. So I'm going to stay underweight that sector at least till the end of the year. Obviously, I believe in biotech, like I said. You know, when I see signs that that's going to work, I'm going to do it again. But not right now.
Okay. So my last question for you is oil this week has been kind of in a pattern intraday. I'm kind of going a little granular on you for a second before I come back with my bigger macro question. It's been weak early, and it's kind of recovered later in the day, and stocks have done well as oil has recovered. It seems that, like, for now, stocks are going to be tied to the direction of oil. So is it possible if we break 40 and we go to, say, 30, and you've kind of outlined potentially that could occur, is there any way that the overall indexes can go higher, or is this something we really want to be paying attention to here to hope that we get some stabilization in the price of oil, and then that is viewed as a positive for stocks?
That's one of the key issues here. In my view, if oil breaks 40 and starts going down, the chance of a stock market disaster is very high. I would be watching that. That's really what I'm watching. And I would say if oil breaks 40 and the spider breaks 202, I would raise an awful lot of cash quickly. That would get me, for example, completely out of the market.
Okay.
100% cash.
So let me put on my thinking out of the box hat for a second and see if you kind of agree with this, given that you've got a master's in international relations. The world kind of changed this last week with Paris. I mean, quite honestly, it should have changed when they bombed Beirut, you know, ahead of it, but it didn't. It took the Paris thing happening, and so now, like, there's lots of countermeasures on scorched earth, blah, blah, blah. It looks like we're revving up the military-industrial complex again, and, you know, at the G20, Obama sat down with Putin, and if we work with them, to me it almost seems like there's going to be some type of sidebar deal and use this event to get the price of oil going back up again, because everyone needs it. Look, the Fed's big problem is deflation, right?
Right.
The whole way out of this 07 into 09 problem was, you know, we needed to reinflate. We haven't been able to do it. And maybe this is kind of like the catalyst that gets that going. What do you think about that kind of scenario, Fred?
Well, I think that that's very possible. You know, one of the things I know a lot of people on the call probably do not like President Obama. I think 50% of Americans don't like him. I think it's more prudent to look at what a president's doing and say what it is you like about what he's doing and what it is you don't. You know, one of the things that Obama has done that I think is interesting, and I don't think a lot of people understand it, but this is how I view it, is Obama tends to work with countries that haven't been friendly to the U.S. on a case-by-case basis rather than just saying they're evil and I'm not going to deal with them at all. And I think that's actually good. When I go back in time, you know, remember when before Richard Nixon went to China, the United States just said Taiwan was China and all of mainland China didn't exist? You know, that used to be the way it was for us people on the call that are older. If you think about it, saying a country the size of China, mainland China, simply doesn't exist is kind of silly, right? I mean, it exists. It's there. It's the biggest damn country on earth. So you kind of, you know, and what Obama might very well do is say Putin is a schmuck in the Ukraine, but we need his help dealing with this ISIS business, just like he's done with the Iranians, whether you like it or not. He said, we don't like Iran, but we'll work with them on a nuclear deal. I know it's no, we're not going to talk to him at all, ever, sort of thing. And it may very well be that that's going on. Jeff, I think, as you say, you know, let's look at something really negative here just for a minute as a possibility. Let's say that all of QE was designed to prevent deflation. It has failed. QE has failed under those circumstances, and I don't see what the replacement is unless it's something like this. You know, the biggest declines in the market and the longest bear markets have traditionally been deflationary, the ones that go on for years, okay? And that's a concern. And I'm not including 74, which was largely extraneous events and due to overvaluation, the period of time from 68, 69 to 82, and bad policies, all those things combined. But the real big, horrible declines have been from deflation. So I think they have to fix it. You know, I am watching eagerly to see if the market starts to react to oil, if it goes back below 40 and really breaks the lows at 38. You know, we start making new lows in oil, we have to watch the market very carefully, and if it starts to go down, we have to believe it and take defensive action. But you're right, this sort of thing may be what gets that done.
Okay, cool. Okay, that's it. I'm turning it back to you.
Good. We're open to questions. Any questions from anyone, remember to hit star 6 to unmute your phones. I hear someone. Question.
Hey, Fred, Scott.
Scott, how are you?
Great, thank you. I would just add to your comment regarding QE and maybe make a comment and feel free to pile on or whatever, but
yeah.
To me, QE has been obviously a failure. And for me, the only thing that's going to turn deflation globally, especially here, is, you know, fiscal policy change. You know, dollar repatriation, lower corporate tax rates, et cetera. I mean, we saw some change in India and some other examples. Hopefully Latin America is maybe moving glacially in that direction. But, you know, for me, in terms of what can go right next year, it has to be fiscal.
Yeah, and Scott, you're at Merrill Lynch, right?
Correct.
Take a look at Michael Hartnett's report on October 13th, his Thundering Word, which is a name I've always hated, where he talks about those kind of changes coming in. And, you know, it's interesting to me. I like Michael. Michael's a great guy and sharp as a tack. And one of the things that looks, and I'm looking at his report now, what he says basically is low bond yields plus low commodity prices equal optimal time to finance infrastructure spending. And, you know, when I look at materials and industrials as sectors and how they're trading right now, they are looking much better and may turn into some of the, you know, where the really good stocks and the best stuff is next year. And I emphasize next year because I still think that the average, you know, money is going to go into the top five or six stocks that are making new highs. In other words, Home Depot, McDonald's, Starbucks, all the same ones we've talked about. But what I will be looking for, one of the things I'm going to be looking for to say this market is getting a lot better going into 2016 and in 2016 is if the accumulation models and such that I keep on materials and industrials continue to improve. I would suggest that any Merrill Lynch advisor who can get the research library take a look at Hartnett's report on 1013. It's very well done. It makes sense, and it should be read.
Yeah, I read him religiously weekly, and his short-term calls have been very prison.
Yeah. Yeah, and but I think that's a great idea. And again, you know, Scott, I'm a technician. What I do when someone sends me a report is I look at the report with interest. I've got, thankfully, a lot of my clients send us reports, and I'll talk about those reports sometimes on the call, not necessarily by name. But those are usually great ideas. The people in these firms think really well. What I tend to do whenever I get an idea like that is I tend to look at my technical indicators and see if the indicators support the idea or whether the indicators say that the idea is full of malarkey. And in this case, I think the ideas, you know, are supported by what we're starting to see in XLB and XLI. There may be some real shots in there. Because of that, the other thing that I would say, by the way, and this is something I completely forgot about in my stupid in my meetings yesterday, I forgot about this because I am stupid sometimes. You know, at this particular juncture in the market, with the market narrow, when you look at our sector review, which is coming out, as I say, today, don't overlook the Dorsey Wright sector-based momentum sectors from PowerShares, who does sponsor me for meetings, because those buy the highest relative strength stocks in the sectors. And much of the time, that's not the way to go. You want to buy the whole sector and not just look at high relative strength. But in this case, with a narrow market, something like PRN and PYZ may very well do better than XLI and XLB, because after all, the hedge funds are buying the stocks that are closest to their highs, and so are high relative strength ETFs. And Scott, you know, when I was at dinner with you guys in Palm Beach Gardens, or where, no, I guess it was in Boca, I didn't think of that. I feel like an idiot now, of course, but I didn't think of it. But I would certainly look at that as a strategy right now. I was about to say it would pay dividends, but it won't, because high dividend stocks generally don't pay dividends. But it could actually be a good strategy.
Very helpful. Can I ask one question?
Sure.
HYG. I know you mentioned bonds, and I agree the stochastics and everything on the TLT are looking good, but HYG is looking really perilous to me, and it tends to, for me, be a big warning sign. Would you throw that with oil breaking 40 as a another?
Yeah, that would say that, to me, the big concern is, and again, Scott, if we have a lot of demand out of China, we're probably not going to have a recession. If we don't have commodity demand and China is the biggest set of it, it's entirely possible that the U.S. will have a recession next year, okay? Japan allegedly is already in one, although when I see a statistic like 0.6, I do think of rounding error, right? In other words, we've entered a recession by 0.6. That may very well be revised in a few months so that we're not in one anymore. But that does say that there's some risk of economic slowing here and that some of these worldwide problems may be starting to affect us. Now, the other thing I've always done to look at the economy is, and I know other guys on the call do this, is I go to Lenox Mall here in Atlanta. That's the premier mall where in the southeast where people come from all over to shop. And if that's empty Thanksgiving week, that's a really bad sign. I can tell you right now that it's not. It's loaded with people. I am certainly hoping that there are less trucks on 285, which is the main freeway here that is known around the country for being so awful. It is still awful. In other words, you're not seeing the signs that you would see to say that the southeastern part of the United States is slowing. So I'm less concerned about HYG, but I'm not playing it. I would also mention, by the way, if you're in that and you decide you want to do a tax swap and you sell that and buy PHB, which is fundamentally weighted, you are getting a better-looking chart. You're still in that area, and it's not, the index is not based on the amount of debt you issue. It's based on the amount, the solvency of the companies that are in the index. So you have a better chance of weathering a recession. The other one that I think we talked about at dinner and that I've mentioned a couple times, but I want to mention again as a really great bond alternative, is PCY, which is yielding over 6. It's emerging market sovereign debt denominated in dollars. I do think that if China's going to get better and the market's going to get better next year, so are emerging markets. And I really like the idea of being paid 6% while I wait. And it's a much better chart than treasuries. And if the dollar gets stronger, that'll help PCY, something which I overlooked when we were talking about it.
Great idea. Thanks.
Other questions from people, and thank you, Scott, for your questions. Those were good, and I'm glad someone else besides me reads Michael. Other questions?
Hey, Fred, it's Philip. How you doing?
Philip, how you doing, man?
Should we just start calling you Bobby Fischer?
No, because, he was so neurotic. My very best quote from Bobby Fischer, by the way, and I love this because it was quintessential Fisher, is he says there's a giant international Jewish conspiracy in chess. They're wrecking everything. And someone said, well, Bobby, you're Jewish. He said, yeah, I know. I'm part of the conspiracy. I just didn't know that I was.
He's a wackadoodle. All right.
Yeah,
hey,
totally whack. Sorry.
I'm sorry I missed it. Could you repeat again what you said about what would make you go all cash? Is 2100 a launching pad for you to the upside for the market? And tell me your thoughts here on Apple, please.
Sure. If oil starts to break down below 38 to 40, and it looks like we've got a commodity recession, commodity deflation acceleration, and, Philip, and the and is important, and the spider starts to move below 202, I would start raising cash. Now, Philip, I said Milton F. Meissner Jr. would go to all cash at that juncture. Realize that I can change my mind the very next day if I want to. You cannot. So I would use below 202 as a cash raising place, below 198 as a cash raising place for more.
Okay.
But to me, the only thing that's really going to cause that here is commodity deflation. at least before the end of the year, because I think these guys are going to chase stuff, and they're just not going to sell for any reason, and frankly, they're going to pray like the Dickens that they can avoid being down 9% for the year somehow. That's what I think is going on, is as Bob Prechter called it once, the slope of hope. Okay, in other words, we're going to see people hoping like hell that they can buy Home Depot and make 10% before the end of the year.
Go ahead. Now, you had mentioned to me once before, you thought 2,100 was a important number, and forgive me if I've missed this on the call already today.
2,111 would get me all in, and I still think we might see 223 on the spider by the end of the year. I mean, that's possible. The numbers, when you punch them in, say that that's possible. It's frankly not probable. If we'd done all the nonsense we did at the end of Q2 and had 6 months to do it, I would have been looking for 223 to 229, just like we did. You know, we had in our forecast for the year. Okay. Now it may be too late, but that looks good. That, you know, we still could do that. And but Philip, a sure bet is if we're going to go to 223, based on my analysis, we're going to go above 211 first.
Okay. And then
so
Apple.
That would do it. And Apple, I'm looking at. Philip, I kind of like Apple here. I got a funny feeling that tomorrow something's going to happen. You know, the computers are going to cause cancer or something like that, or the computers are going to cure world hunger. Either way, the gap at 120 exactly is going to fill, and all those options will expire, or the options at 115 will all expire worthless. I can't tell which. But Apple, Philip, is reacting very well to the daily stochastic. If you are waiting to put money in Apple until the daily stochastic moves above 20 after coming down, you're adding Apple at good times. That would have been around 112, 113, and at 118, you're okay. So I'd be trading it along with the stochastics. It's not my favorite, oh, goody, outperformance stock, but I certainly have no qualms with selling Apple, and everyone on the call should know that I'm an Apple products user and a maniac about it. So, I mean, I love the company, and the technicals are fine. It just may not be a mega outperformer.
All right. Hey, Fred, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving, Philip. It was so good seeing all you guys.
Yeah, we enjoyed it, too. Great seeing you.
Sure.
Thanks a lot.
Next question. Any other questions?
Hey, Fred, it's John.
John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving next week.
Planning on it. A lot of travel immediately afterwards because I leave for Seattle and Portland the very next day, and I'm out there for like a week or so. So anyone on the call that's from there that wants to see me, shoot me an email, and we'll work it.
Has it not rained here enough?
No, I miss the rain terribly, and I want to get – I know. Yeah.
Quick question. I know you were talking about the industrials, and if you look at XLI, it's just almost a triple top here at the 55 number. If that breaks out, are there any particular names you like in there?
You know, I will look at that, and the real question is when it breaks out. If it breaks out in the next few days – just look at the industrial sector and buy anything that's within 10% of its highs.
Okay.
Okay.
Perfect.
And I know that sounds really, really stupid and not like investing at all, but that's what will probably work going into the end of the year.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay.
I think that's it. So do you like GE?
Cool. I do.
Can you take a look at it?
It's still making new highs. The blasted stock, and I own this, by the way, full disclosure, I own this stock myself, 34, 35 by the end of the year because of the lemmings and not for any good reason.
Okay. What's the banks have really kind of, you know, you think they would have responded a little better to everybody kind of basically confirming that it looks like they're going to do a 25 basis point raise, but they've kind of been weak here. What is XLF telling you?
You know, XLF still looks fine. It's trading up. There's huge resistance, 25, 26 on the monthly chart. One of the things that I've been saying is that it's going to take a while to get through that, and I think it is. You know, one of the big indications here, John, is we've had targets for the year for Bank of America at 18. And it's been up there a couple times this year. It's been a little bit through. If Bank of America starts going through 1850, everybody should think about buying that and buying some of the other bank stuff. That stuff is all looking good. But again, John, what may be happening here in general is the market is anticipating the rate rise so that when they do it, the initial reaction is going to be either a sell-off in these things or nothing at all, right?
Okay.
These may go to where they're going to go, just like bonds. Bonds could go to where they're going to go way before this happens.
And they kind of pretty much telegraphed that yesterday with their note. They basically said, we're going to raise 25 basis points, and then we're probably not going to do anything for a long time after that. So,
you know, all I can say is if anyone can come up with a better telegraphed rate rise in the history of the Federal Reserve than this one, I would love to know the time period when that occurred. Because I honestly don't think there is one. You know, I think we sit here and we say to ourselves, golly, when the Fed raises rates, fecal matter could hit the aerating device, right? and obviously, you know, they've got to be thinking about that too. You know, they're not dumb people up there. Okay, I'm sure that they're very worried about that. We tend to think, well, they don't seem to care. We know they care. Okay, there's one thing you don't see, thank God, in the Fed minutes, because we used to have this at the MTA when I was president, was we would go into executive session so we could talk amongst ourselves as a board and not take minutes. You know, can you imagine the set of Fed minutes that come out where they say, let's talk about raising interest rates in the economy, and then it just says executive session, and then it stops the executive session, and Janet Yellen says, boy, I like Bill's necktie. That looks really, really good. You know, obviously they can't do that, okay? But you know that these guys are talking amongst themselves and are worried about this effect. So, you know, I'm sure, you know, if they don't raise rates in December, I think the market is going to say, my God, something must be so bad that no one's willing to talk about it and sell off. Right. I mean, I think that would be an unmitigated disaster. I think they know that. I think that they are looking for all sorts of reasons to raise them, and they will.
Great. I know you said you think we still have a shot at 223, and you've been really good since I've been with you the last couple of years of the year-end calls. What do you think in regards to, is there a percentage amount? You're like saying, I think a 20% will hit 223, but I think it's about a 50%. We're going to end up around 215 or so.
I would say 20%, but, you know, one of the things about following trends is to not try to figure out where it ends ahead of time. You know, the hardest thing I have, John, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. You know, advisors want levels, and I want indicator configurations. I don't really care so much about the level, okay? That's why when we went below 205, I didn't have a conniption fit. I got probably 6 or 7 emails saying, golly, we're below 225. Or 205, has the world ended, okay? You know, so what I try to do is predict where the indicators are going to be and what the level they're going to be at is when they get there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the indicators support an advance to 223, especially the weekly Fed's price oscillator. If that goes back up to 15 from here, that will put us around 223 to 225. If we do it in the next few, say, in the next 4 or 5 weeks, okay?
Okay, perfect.
So that's why I say that number is still on the table, okay? Will it get there? Blast all if I know, because you really don't know. But I'd certainly be in the S&P right now on the long side. I would not be out of the S&P. And again, John, what I think I said was earlier in the call, the big trap here for people, especially for our advisors who are measured on the S&P, whether or not that's stupid is immaterial, is the S&P still looks like it can rally even if the broad market doesn't do as well. And it looks like it could do it for the next 2 months, so we have to try to play it. Now, you can say it's the ninth inning and there's one batter out and you've only got two more batters to go, But, you know, the last time I saw a baseball game where you were in the ninth inning and there was one batter out, the game still went on until all three got out, right? So we have to be in there even if it's late innings. And, John, I think we could see some real performance chasing into the end of the year, and we'll be shaking our heads at the end of the year going, my God, how could they have been so stupid, honestly?
Yeah.
But it's not investing anymore. For the last month and a half of this year, I don't think there's going to be any investing done. None.
Yeah, it's just saving clients is what it is at this point.
Yeah, it's going to be, I want to save my job, so I'm going to buy Home Depot and hope it goes up 25%.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Well, thanks, Fred, and have a great Thanksgiving and a safe travel.
I will do, and you guys too. And, you know, sometime in mid to late December when I get back from my trips to Seattle, Portland, and New York, let's go and have lunch again.
That sounds great. Definitely we'll set that up.
Cool. Other questions? I know this is run a little later than we normally run, but I can still take in a couple more questions if anyone wishes. Going once. Justin, are you there? No, I'm kidding. Justin always comes in with the last question. Any, if there are no more questions, going once, going twice. Very good. Everyone have a wonderful holiday week.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm here. Do you want me? Sorry.
Yeah, Fred, it's Justin. How about waste management?
Justin, I'm sorry. I was teasing you. What can I do for you, Justin? I know you wake up late.
How about waste management? And then is Costco on your favorite list with there with Starbucks and Home Depot?
Waste management is no longer WMX. It's WM. Let me look.
Yeah,
and again, Justin, the first thing I always look at for the next month and a half is, are you 10% from the highs? The high was 55, down 550 minus. So, yeah, it's within 10% of the highs. It could definitely go. And, I mean, in other words, if you have it in models, and Costco, yeah, again, it's making new highs. I'm afraid you have to buy this and hope it gets to 200 by the end of the year, as stupid as that may sound to you.
I hope it works. That's great.
I do, too. I mean, the great thing about this is if you know these guys can do it, you could tag along with them for a while, and but we can get out earlier. We don't have the same problems they have.
Right. Wonderful.
Other questions?
Thanks, Fred.
For sure, man. Have a good holiday week.
Fred, quick follow-up?
Yeah, sure.
I wrote down the wrong symbols. I wrote down PON and PYV versus XLI.
Yeah, let me give you that because I'm looking at the blasted thingy right in front of my face. Paul Robert Nancy is the sector-based momentum Dorsey Wright Industrials ETF. PYZ as in zebra, Paul, yes, zebra, is basic materials. You can also go to the PowerShares website and just get the sector-based momentum indexes. They're all DWA, which stands for Dorsey Wright, which means high relative strength.
Great, thanks.
Got it. Any other questions? Going once, going twice. Very well. This will end the Fred Report technical market call for November 19th, as unbelievable as that sounds, 2015. Everyone have a great week, and we'll see you after Thanksgiving.